Well, this evening, our speaker is Len Froeslin. Len is the conference center manager for the Glen. And I cannot think of a job that probably requires or has any more pressure on a person than what Len's job has on him. He represents the navigators to everyone that comes through here. He is the one who is responsible for organizing, administering, setting up, arranging all the conferences that come through here every year through the Glen. And for example, now during this week, there will have been a total of 12 different university campuses represented. And you can imagine, I mean, it's difficult enough just to try to arrange for one conference with one campus. But I think there's probably about three or four different conferences going on with each of these different university campuses. And so it's an awesome job. And it is one that requires much in the way of servanthood. Because much of what Len does goes unnoticed by many of us. I mean, you know, we come here and we sign up and we get a key. We go to our room. We come to a meeting. We go out and there's the coffee break waiting for us. And, you know, we don't see what goes on behind the scenes. And Len and his crew are the ones who are responsible for arranging all of this. And I think have as much, if not more, to do with the success and making it possible for God to speak to us at a conference like this than any speaker or anyone else. So he's been doing this for a while. He's been with the NAS for 20 years and certainly is qualified to speak to us tonight on this area of servanthood. And it's a very special privilege we have to have him with us tonight. I'm going to let Len come up and share a little bit about his testimony with us, and then he'll go ahead and come on in and share with us about servanthood. So let's give Len a big hand.
Tremendous. Your singing is just like mine. When I sing, I like to pick out a song that's written in B-flat, have the pianist play it in B, and I flat it myself. It keeps it simple. The only singer in my house was a sewing machine, by the way. That's what the problem was. I figured if I had any music in me, I must have a lot in me, by the way. None has ever come out. Everybody have one? I did take trombone lessons for a while, but then I let that slide too. So. Jeez. Yeah, right. Yeah. You're either slow of mind or just tired. I know McDonald wouldn't get it, but the rest of you should have. I became a Christian when I was 9 years old. See, I'd be about 37 now, but I was sick a year. You'll be all right. When I was 13, I told the Lord I wanted to experience more in my Christian life than I seen anyone around me experience. I had nobody to put down on that statement to him, but I just wanted more. I wanted to go the whole length of it. I think that was indication of my heart, what was in my heart that God had done. I came to Christ at the right age, I would say. Between the ages of 9 and 11 is when people are very God conscious. And so it's a good time if you have kids in your family, nephews, nieces, grandchildren, whatever you have, brothers and sisters. his work on leading the Christ at that age because they're very responsive to things. A year or two later, they become very self-conscious. The body starts to change, and you're very aware of yourself. You feel clumsy, and everything goes wrong, and you don't like your looks and everything else. And a couple of years after that, you get very opposite sex conscious. You're taken up with the girls all the time. You have no time to think about God. And that's usually during high school age. And then you get into college, and you're very intellect conscious, and it becomes more and progressively more difficult to get people to come to Christ. So if you can help people do so when they're young, it's to their advantage. Most of the missionaries over the years that have gone overseas have been saved when they were kids, grew up in the church, committed themselves to Christ, and took it from there. Because it's hard for people when they get older to change, uproot, and so on. So there's a lot to be said about people coming to Christ at a young age. Let me move back a little bit. Some people can't see me there. I came to Glen Eyrie in 1960 to a training program and found out I'm a very slow learner. 20 years later, I'm still here. I'd been in a Bible school in eastern Kentucky in the Appalachian Mountains. And after I graduated, I joined the staff of the school and was kind of buried in the ministry that they had. I made contact with Dick Hightower, who was a NAV rep out in New Jersey, where my home was. Spent an hour with him. 24 hours later, he called me and said, I've been accepted in the training program at the Glen. They want me out there as soon as I can get there. And God did a wonderful miracle in uprooting me. Instead of in 6 months, like I thought it would be, it was within 2 weeks, and I was out here. And got involved in this training program, was on the maintenance crew. Spent 7 summers up at Eagle Lake as maintenance man. Became the director of Eagle Lake Camps in 1968. Pretty good jump, wasn't it? Go from maintenance man to director. I didn't know anything about what I was doing, but I was director. And in 1970, when John Crawford, who was heading up Glen Eyrie, went to New Zealand, he asked me if I'd like to move in the conference office. Evidently figured I must have had some ability in administration, so planted me in here, and my responsibility at that time was to develop a year-round conference activity. And I had zero knowledge of what to do in that, so I just prayed and asked God to do it for me. And over the years, he has developed it, so we can hardly keep up with it anymore. And we turn about, I would say, a third to half as many people, groups away as we take on. And we stay pretty well booked up most of the year. And I have written around to many local places like ours, conference centers or resorts, and gotten brochures so I can refer them to people, to somebody. I always figured out that if you can't take them, people will never like a no answer. So I said, do you have any alternatives, places to go, if you can't come here? And if they say no, I told them I would send them a packet of brochures from other places, and they could contact them and see where they could find another place. This takes the pressure off the whole thing. You're not really refusing them. You're helping them and serving them by saying, I can't do it, but here's somebody else that may be able to help you. And so it was fun to find ways of doing those kind of things for people. And so the subject of our time tonight is serving the Lord with hilarity. Now, if you had a question about this area of servanthood, what would you ask? Maybe you never gave it a thought, but I'm sure some of you have some questions back in your mind. Okay. How do you determine needs? That's good. We'll see if we can cover that during the course of the session. We won't answer them on the cuff here. Any others? One routine one is, how do I know when people are taking advantage of me? if I'm going to be a servant. And we will hit that one, I know, by the end of it. And I think you'll be surprised as we come out of this thing as to the answer to that one. It's kind of pleasant. Let me just pass out a few verses, and if you have a, I assume you have your Bible with you, instead of taking time to look it up as we get to each one, we'll just have it ready. And we'll move along rapidly. To go through this whole sheet would take about an hour and a half, and we just want to take about 40, 45 minutes on it. Philippians 2, 9 to 11, I'd like to take, just raise your hand, I'll point to you. Okay? John 13, 13 to 17. Acts 6:3 here in the front row. Okay. Acts 6:3. Philippians 2:5. Romans 15:2. Philippians 2:20 and 21 then, okay? Mark 9:34 and 5. Okay. Where are we? Galatians 6, 9 and 10. Okay, and 1 John 3, 16 and 17 in the NIV. Do you have that? Okay, the rest I can quote probably. Okay, we'll leave it there, and as we come to them, I'll have your verse ready and we'll deal with it. So, a word of prayer. Now, Father, again tonight, we want to delve into your word. Some of us are tired from skiing and others from other activity. And we do ask you to give us the right response to your word tonight. We know you will speak because your word is quick and powerful. And we just want to respond to it and obey it as we hear it. So thank you for ministering to us. In Jesus' name, amen. First thing to do when you study a subject is define your terms. A dictionary isn't always the best if you're using, for instance, the King James Bible, because terms have changed over the years and you have to be careful. Dictionary may not define the same word that you're looking up. But on this particular subject, we can find the same, or the right definition out of both a dictionary and a concordance. So the dictionary said, a servant is a person employed by another for menial tasks. One who exerts himself for the benefit of another, his master. And that's a key point. You're exerting yourself for someone else, and that someone else is the person you're serving. The concordance says, or the Bible definition of it from the encounter with Mary and Martha. Martha was serving, and Mary was sitting at Jesus' feet, and it's that tone that we're looking after. What was Martha doing? She was an attendant, to wait upon menially as a host, friend, or teacher. So you can serve in almost any capacity. Technically, it is to act as a Christian deacon, to minister, to serve, or to use the office of a deacon. So we'll look into the scripture and see what it says about who we're serving in Philippians 2, 9 to 11. Right here, Jesus Christ is depicted as the absolute sovereign of the universe. Because he humbled himself and did what he did in the world, God exalted him to the position of authority in the universe. So he is established as the Lord of all. So let's see what he did while he was here in John 13, 13 to 17.
You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is the messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed to do them.
Okay. He knew who he was when he was here, and he was explaining it to his disciples, that I, your Lord and your Master, have washed your feet. At that point, probably the lowliest thing you could do. The issue is not washing feet. The issue is the concept of being willing to do what other people will not do, either can't do or will not do. And to think nothing about your own dignity, but to see and tend to the needs of people. And he says, if I, your Lord and Master, have done these things, then I have set a pace for you, and happy are you, or blessed is your life, if you follow that same kind of a lifestyle. He wasn't here to build a reputation. He wasn't here to make a mark for himself in the world. He was here to serve. And he says, if you'll do that, then your life will be characterized by happiness. All right, let's see if the disciples picked up on it. Acts 6:3.
But select from among you, rather than 7 men of good reputation, full of spirit and wisdom, whom we may put in charge.
All right, whom we may put in charge of this task. What was the task of the deacons in the early church? Two, really, if you remember the context. Serving tables. What else was it? Were they doing? Pardon? Yes, there were some being freed. They were setting some aside to study the Word and pray and minister the Word. But what was another responsibility of those who were chosen as deacons, huh? Serving tables, but they were also taking food to widows. And this is where part of the problem came in. And there was a little bit of a dissension in there. So here are two responsibilities of a deacon. And the word deacon means servant. And a deacon was chosen to do menial tasks, like waiting on tables and taking food to widows, the first Meals on Wheels program. See? Now let's look at the qualifications required to be a deacon. It's unbelievable. What's the first thing they had to have? A good reputation. Let's just do some thinking into that and see what you can come up with. What? Why would you have to have a good reputation to wait on tables and take food to widows? Dependability, right. Anything else? That's right. You're representing the church, you're representing Jesus Christ. So if your reputation as a person is not up to par, then it's going to reflect on the Lord. And if you're part of the church and people see you with a poor reputation around town, then you're not a good testimony to Jesus Christ. What else? Any other thoughts? All right, what's the second requirement? Why in the world do you have to be full of the Holy Spirit to wait on tables and take food to widows? That doesn't seem to fit our concept, does it? If you're going to minister the Word, you should be full of the Spirit. But to do these chores, why? That's right. It's still a spiritual ministry. The activity in itself is not spiritual. You are the spiritual one. And no matter what you do, there is no distinction between secular and spiritual in a Christian's experience. We categorize things. That's my work over there. That's secular. I go to minister at night. I go to church and worship on Sunday, and we cut our lives in pieces. But with God, there is no distinction between the secular and the spiritual. Because he said in Romans 12:1 and 2 that if you'll present your body as a living sacrifice, then whatever you do is an act of worship unto God. Because it's you that's the spiritual one. And if your life is characterized and controlled by the Spirit, then he is the one that's initiating the thing that you're doing. And you're doing it as unto the Lord, and it's an act of worship to God. That's your worshipful service. It says reasonable in some of the translations, but it's worshipful service. So no matter what you do, it's an act of worship. See? So that puts a whole new slant on the menial tasks of life. Now, I can wait on tables and not be serving. I mean, people are doing that all over the country. In all the restaurants, they're waiting tables, but they're not serving people. And you can tell that in the way they treat you half the time. And they abandon you sometimes. You got to go last with them to get them back to get another cup of coffee. Because they're not concerned about you, they're concerned about doing their job and getting the tip. Okay, why does a person have to be spirit-filled to wait on tables? Do it as unto the Lord first. To right, maintain the right attitude. What's going to happen after 2 weeks? You're taking food to widows and they start griping that they don't like this. And I just had a good experience. I was home from my mom's funeral. And we talked to my aunt, my mom's sister, about 75 years old and crippled up with arthritis. And we talked about going into a home. And she didn't want to go to this place because they didn't have a menu you could choose from. And she says, I don't eat everything. And I could see myself planning right back to that situation where you had to be full of the Spirit to kind of handle that kind of a woman, you know. You bring fish and she doesn't like fish, and so she kind of reads you off for bringing it. And here you're just doing a service, see. So it's going to take being filled and possessed by the Holy Spirit to be able to take the flack you're going to get from people. And most people are not kind when it comes to food. You can find that out in a restaurant by just being nice to the gal. You'll find out you win her over immediately by being positive to her. All right, any other thoughts on why to be filled with the Spirit? All right, what's another requirement? The third one. Pardon? Full of wisdom. Why would that be?
Wisdom responding to various situations.
You bet. Sure. And how to respond to people. To give a soft answer when some unkind words come out. To know how to handle a situation when somebody flies off the handle. There's so many things you can get into in this. It takes the wisdom of God to know how to conduct yourself in response to people. And you see, if you're going to do this long term, like say the deacon, I don't know how long they were appointed for. Nowadays, they have it for a 2-year period in the church or so. And if you're going to persist in this responsibility, and you're doing it in the energy of the flesh, it's not going to be long. You'll be in the job. You'll be replaced pretty quick because you wouldn't be able to handle this kind of thing. It's too menial, too much personal interaction. And unless you're spirit controlled, why, it's going to be a very difficult road for you. So it takes wisdom to know how to respond. It probably takes wisdom to discern needs in the process of taking food out or serving tables. Simple things like we're serving buffet style. And so you come in first, say, at the table. And so people start filling in around you. How do you discern needs in that situation? My gals have been after me to get some lazy Susans for the center of the tables, the round tables, so you could just spin them around. I said, no, that would chop off one of the biggest lessons we can learn at Glen Eyrie. Because then everybody fends for themselves. See, I can discern needs that if I sit down at the table first and then you come in with your plate, I have an opportunity to meet that need, the needs you have, before you even realize you have a need. See? Just by taking a glance at your plate, if you have a roll in the plate, there's probably butter on the table, and I can get that butter, whether by myself or ask somebody else to do it, to pass that over to him, because he's going to be needing it in just a second. Salt and pepper, sugar for his coffee, whatever. And to be constantly thinking of the other people arriving and trying to have those things available to them, because no matter where you sit at the table, everything you need is always at the other end. That's not just the way it is. It's on the other side of the table, at the other end. And if I get myself involved in conversation and I'm not paying attention to other people, it makes it very difficult for them to get what they need because they don't want to interrupt me. I go through that myself. I don't feel like asking and interrupting a conversation to get what I want, so I just do without. See? Whereas it would be wise on the part of those other people to be aware of those who are coming in, and even though they're in conversation, to just make a quick glance and see what they can do to help anticipate those needs. See, and that's where serving becomes fun, because you're meeting needs that people don't even realize they have. And that's where it becomes hilarious to you. All right? If we're going to be good deacons, no matter what our responsibilities are, there's some characteristics or biblical traits that we need to develop. And the first one is the mind of Christ in Philippians 2:5.
Have this attitude for yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus.
Okay, the King James says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. In other words, start thinking and developing yourself the same way Christ did. And what was his attitude in the context? Remember? It says, who, though he was God, didn't think it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, took upon himself the form of a servant and the likeness of man. This is the mind of Christ, to think not low of yourself, but lowly. To have a sane estimate. Don't think yourself the big hotshot. Don't think yourself a nothing. Get that in balance and have a right perspective about yourself, and then give yourself to serving people. I have one illustration down here. How do I develop this mentality? I was in my office in the den, in the conference office there, and I got a call one day to go up to the second floor of the castle, and as I kind of jogged out, and up the main stairway was a little gal sitting on the bottom step, and she had a verse pack out. And as I went by her, I said, what are you doing, reversing your views? And as I passed her and I thought about that, I said, that's interesting. That's exactly what she's doing. As she reviews her verses, she's also reversing her views, because she's starting to think the way Christ thinks, or the way God thinks. And so how do you develop this mentality of being a servant? But by getting into the Word and getting the Word into you, and you'll begin to think about things the way God thinks. You don't get it from watching Dallas and all these other shows. It just doesn't come that way. The world has different terms for this kind of a lifestyle. One is egoism, which means valuing everything only in reference to my own personal viewpoint. How does it affect me? Which is today's philosophy in America. If it feels good, do it. That's egoism. Altruism is the opposite and was coined to mean unselfish concern for or devotion to the welfare of others. Very difficult for a normal human being to accomplish. Some people seem to be that way. But I would say generally there's an ulterior motive as to how big a tax break can I get by giving this away. It may want to help honestly, but there's always a motive in there. Dale Carnegie expressed a description of altruism in the following statement. I got the feeling that I had done something for him without his being able to do anything whatever in return for me. Now there is the core. When you're willing to serve somebody else without them having an opportunity to do anything back for you. That's the kind of people you want to serve. And looking for nothing in return. I had a niece, lives in California, 25 years old, and she went home to stay with my mom the last months of her life. And when I got home at Christmas time and talking with her, I said, why don't we just kind of spice things up, and we'll put a Christmas tablecloth on a table, and perhaps you can make some nice fancy things. And she said, well, Len, Uncle Len, it won't be appreciated. See, she was here to serve my mom, and even though mom was kind of out of it because she had suffering pretty heavily with cancer and going physically downhill, she wasn't doing a lot of things because it wouldn't be appreciated. Isn't that the way we are by nature? I always got to have things appreciated. I got to have the feedback that's going to keep me, my morale boosted up on this issue. I'm not doing things for somebody just for the sake of and joy of doing it for them. And whether mom could ever recognize it or not wouldn't make a bit of difference. Do it for her. See, make her last days as pleasant and enjoyable. She recognizes she may not be able to express it, but boy, go ahead and do it for her. What? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I went and bought a Christmas tablecloth, and I tried to set the table differently every meal, and brighten it up, because when you're facing death in the face, you want to get as much as cheerful as you can. And I did talk to her about that before I left. She didn't have much background in spiritual input, so it's a little bit difficult to deal with her as we could you. For me to do it? No, it depends on the person. You have to be a little bit careful. But I'd worked, my niece had lived out here for years, so I got somewhat acquainted with her. I knew I could approach her on it. She's not the most open person in the world, but we dealt with it. But of course, being that way in my lifestyle, it's a little tough for me to swallow that kind of response. I have a hard time with it. I don't understand how people, but that's, see, I'm gifted that way, so it's, I have to get the feeling of the other side as well, people who are not gifted that way to serve, that realize they have to learn it. All right, second characteristic. Develop the mind of Christ, and I have to learn to put others first. And I put that word in there, learning. You see, you'll hear things tonight, but you haven't learned them until you make it a practice. Then you've learned them. So you can go away from here and you can't really honestly say you've learned this thing. You heard it. You realize you see the lesson, but you haven't learned it until you start doing it. So we have to learn to put other people first. Romans 15:2. All right, let each one of us please his neighbor for his good and edification. What can I do for you that will build you up, that will set you up for the future? One of my objectives in being at Glenary is to help you accomplish your objectives while you're here. So when I deal with Don and Greg, I want to get all the information I can so I know what I need to do to help set the groundwork and prepare the place and the situation so that when you come, you are successful in your week. It might look like there's nothing to putting on a conference at Glenary, but there's a horrendous amount of work beforehand. And the more facts, the more information we have, the better we can serve you. The serving isn't simply, you know, having the food on the table when it's time. That's normal routine duty. That's just a chore. But the serving is in these other areas where you don't even realize that you had a need and we have already met it and you don't even know about it. See? And that's where it all comes in. So if you accomplish your objective and if you go away from here feeling like you had a tremendous time, then I've accomplished my objective. So you're gratified and I'm gratified. See? We're both winners. So I'm giving myself to helping you accomplish your objectives, and I'll be successful myself with my goals. Okay, Philippians 2, 20 and 21 talks about Timothy. And Paul said of him that I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state. And if you think into the team that Paul had built around him, and let's just name some of the guys that he had around him. Epaphroditus, Silas, Titus, Mark? Luke, Dr. Luke?
Aristarchus,
whoever the... Barnabas, right? He was there. Yeah, all these hard names. Yeah, all right, look at that key men that Paul traveled with and ministered with, and he says there's only one guy who's ever picked up this out of my life. I have only one man who is like-minded, who will naturally care for your state. And Timothy, saved as a young man, a young kid probably, at home, had it on his heart to put other people first, to live his life for other people. It wasn't just an idea, it was a matter of fact. It was his first nature, not his second nature, to tend to the needs of other people. And Paul gives him a commendation. Boy, what an epitaph to have in your tombstone. He put others first. When I was growing up in Sunday school and all these things, why, they had a little acrostic, and I'm not too big on acrostics, but they talked about having joy in your life. And the way to do it is put Jesus first, others second, and yourself last. And it does say a lot that particular one. Jesus Christ is my Lord. I'm here to serve Him. How do I serve Him? I serve Him by serving other people. And I put myself last. It's not that I neglect myself. I have lots to do. I mean, you have your own basic chores. You have to live life. But you're giving yourself and your first concern to other people to see that they're tended to. And then you get to yourself. For a while I was reading Oswald Chambers in My Utmost for His Highest, and a quote that stood out to me for many years is this one I have written down. Sanctification is being taken up with God's interest in other people, whether it's spiritual or material or physical, whatever. That is the process of sanctification, is getting you off yourself, getting you to quit thinking about number one and start focusing on other people and seeing what you can do to contribute to them. All right, we develop the mind of Christ. We learn to put other people first. Number three is we seek to serve, not to advance. I'll tell you what I mean in a moment. Mark 9, 34 and 5. Want to be top banana? American philosophy is, boy, climb the ladder. Get to the top. Whatever it costs, get to the top. And in the process, you trample on people, and doesn't make a bit of difference how many people you hurt or kill in the process. Just get to the top. There's an outfit up in Connecticut that came out and gave us what they call a personal motivation test. And you dig back into your life and think back to, and write down experiences you had in which you felt you were successful and experiences that were gratifying to you. And you wrote all those down and then sent that paper back to them in Connecticut. And they evaluated it and they sent the evaluation back and told you what your basic motivation is and how God made you and what He intended, how He intended to use you in the whole scheme of things on earth. Because everybody is gifted differently. We all have a place. And so, my gifts are what I knew they were. To serve. The gift of helps. I knew that. And they confirmed it. I have told the navigator leadership above me, don't ever promote me to the next job. I don't want it. Being the linear director. I'd be a fish out of water. I would hit the Peter principle right away and flunk out. Why? Because I found my platform. This is what I'm made to do, and this is what I enjoy doing. These men have given this particular, it's not a test, it's just, I don't know what you call a thing. We'll call it a test just for the sake of it. To most major corporations in America, secular and Christian. And they have found out that 90% of the top management in American business today have reached the Peter Principle. 90%. You see, a guy may be good in the factory punching out things on a press, and he may be able to put out more than three other men in a given time. And so they notice that, and they make him the floor supervisor. And so he goes around encouraging the other guys on the floor, showing them how he does it. And he's successful. And so he does well there, and so they promote him, and they take him out off the floor and put him in the office. And all of a sudden he nosedives and he quits. Because he reached that Peter Principle, it's called, one level above what he should be functioning at. See? And in America, when we're striving to get to the top, we don't belong at the top. Very few people belong at the top. And there's no sense pushing yourself to climb that ladder, because there's more suicide up there and more divorces and troubled marriages and all kinds of problems when you get up there, because you gave all yourself to getting there. What is that? Peter Drucker came up with it, maybe? I forget how it initiated. I'm that Peter out. That's a good one. You know, Dan, why they call it the Peter Principle? I'll have to look into that. Good question. Okay, the natural inclination of the heart is to aspire to prominence. We all want to be a big shot. We all want to be up front. We want to be known. We want to be acclaimed. You want to be a Michael Jackson that gets 6 Emmys at one time. See, it's going to destroy that kid. He's way too young to be able to receive that. See, it's nice to be applauded. It's nice to be recognized, but it's going to destroy him in due time here. And you'll find out he can't handle that. Way too much success for a young kid. See, Marilyn Monroe had some basic needs that never got met. And she pursued it in this world. And it drove her to suicide. Trying to get out front. Be number one. Be everything you can be. I don't say you shouldn't be everything you can be, but don't strive to be number one if you're not made to be number one. Let God put you there if you're supposed to be there. If you're not a servant when you're in the role of a servant, then you'll never be a servant when you're in the role of a leader. So now is the time to begin to learn to serve. All right, the fourth one is to learn to be observant. Isaiah 42:20 says, "Seeing many things, thou observest not." I wonder how many of you today walk past a paper styrofoam cup in the bushes somewhere along between here and the carriage house. Piece of paper, a cigarette butt or something laying on the ground. You noticed it, but it didn't register enough to do something about it. Seeing many things, you don't really observe. Galatians 6, 9 and 10.
Let us not grow tired of doing this, but let us be going on here in the ultimate harvest of the church. Let us then do good to all men, opportunity offers, especially to those who belong to the Christian company.
Okay, as you therefore have opportunity, do good unto all men. You won't be able to hit everybody, but you will have a circle of people in which you will be able to serve. Some people on Glen Eyrie worked here for 2 years, and I even know very little about them because I just don't have that much contact with them. I don't get a chance to serve them just because we don't touch base that often. But as you have opportunity, then take advantage of it and do good unto all men, and especially to Christian people. All right, here's a practical way. The sequel to John 3:16.
This is how we know the Lord is. Jesus Christ laid down his life. We have to lay down our life for our brothers. If anyone has material possessions, he sees his brother in need, has no pity on him. How can the love of God be?
God so loved the world that he gave his Son. The best he had. And he withheld nothing. He's saying now, this is how we know what love is. The only place in the Bible that we have a definition of love. 1 Corinthians 13 tells us characteristics. This says, this is how we know what love is, that Christ Jesus laid down his life for us. There is no greater love than that, that I'm willing to say no to myself and give myself completely for you. If it costs me my life, I'll do it. That is love. Then he says, now let's get practical about it. If you see your neighbor has a material need and you have the resources to help meet that need and you don't take any action, then you can't say that the love of God dwells in you. That's where it begins. You have to make an observation of a person's need. Sometimes you'll hear about it through somebody else or whatever. But then you need to let that sink in and figure out what you can do to help on it. You need to be alacritous. I read Psalm 100 in my quiet time one morning and it said, serve the Lord with gladness. And when I got to my little supervisor's meeting on Monday morning, I asked one of the gals to get the dictionary and see what gladness means, and it means with hilarity. And somebody brought up this word alacrity, and that means to respond with cheerful readiness. I'm always looking for a way to serve, and if I see an opportunity, I'm going to jump for it. See? I'm not in competition with anybody. I'm just going to grab every chance I get to serve somebody. The next one sounds very carnal, but it's very scriptural. Desire to please. And if you'll look up those verses, you'll find it states it that way. In 2 Chronicles 10:7, King Solomon had died. His son Jehoshaphat was in line to take over the kingdom. And he went to the men that Solomon had in his cabinet, and he said, gentlemen, how would you suggest that I, what kind of a rulership should I have? And they said, if you'll be kind to these people and speak well to them and please them, then they'll be your servants forever. If you'll be kind to them, speak well to them, and seek to please them, they'll be your servants forever. He said, give me 3 days and I'll think about it. I'll get back to you. He went to his own peers and he said, how do you think I should handle this? And they said, you know, your father was a mean cuss. He had what they call conscripted labor or forced labor. And I think the people of Israel probably, well, we idolized Solomon. They probably didn't see him in the same way. You know, some people said Harry Truman's reign as president will be noted in history. But while he was in office, we didn't care that much for him. See, that's the way it goes. And Solomon had all his forced labor, and so the people of Israel probably hated his guts, you know. He's probably the General Patton type, who had objectives out there, and whatever it cost to meet those objectives, that was the price everybody's going to pay. If it called for shooting some donkeys and kicking them over the bridge into the river, it didn't make any difference. Whatever the price, get the objective. See? It doesn't matter how you feel about it or how you get hurt in the process, just get the job done. And so these peers of Jehoshaphat's, not Jehoshaphat, Jeroboam's, excuse me, said, if your father's reign could be compared to the size of your pinky, then we would really pour it onto the people and make it about the size of your thigh. I mean, really make it rough on them. And he thought about that, and he went back to the people of Israel, and he said, I have decided to take the counsel of my peers, and if you think my father's reign was tough, wait till you see me in action. He said, and if my father's reign was this tough on you, mine is going to be this tough. And 10 tribes thumbed their nose at him and said, hang it on your beak, pal. And they went and got their own king. The counsel was, if you'll seek, you'll be kind to these people, you'll seek to please them and say nice things to them, they'll be your servants forever. He could have won the people over by serving them, but he didn't do it. He wanted to be at the top. He wanted to rule and reign and take control. And that's not what people want, and that's not what God intended. Here's a good verse written out for you. Another characteristic to develop is seek the advantage of other people. When I read that, it took me a while as I meditated upon it, and a couple of days later it dawned on me what it was saying. Let no one seek his own advantage, but rather that of his neighbor. When it dawned on me what it was saying, I said, Lord, by your grace, help me to do that from now on. That everybody I touch, everybody I encounter today, help me to leave them advantage in some way, whether it's a smile, a word of encouragement, taking time to pray with them, sharing a scripture verse, getting them a cup of coffee, whatever it is. Everybody I touch today, I want them to leave me having been advantaged in some way. That they're ahead because they met me. Wouldn't that be a way to live? I think that's a tremendous concept. Seek the advantage of other people. I didn't know how to say the last one, be considerate, but Hebrews 10:24, it says, consider one another and provoke unto love and to good works. You know what it's like if I had a little water pistol in my hand, I stood here and just kept sprinkling Don over here during the course of the thing. When I went to go out of this room, he'd have had a cup of water and he'd doused me the first chance he got. See? And the next time he saw me or I saw him, I would have a number 10 can. See? And when he saw me again, he'd have a mop bucket. And I'd go get the garden hose. And he'd go get the fire hose. See? There is no end to that one. You want to stop that kind of nonsense soon. The Bible is talking about provoking one another positively. To provoke means to get under your skin, to irritate. See? But here it's being used in a positive sense, that I do good for Don and I irritate him to the point he wants to do something back for me. See? And then he does something back. And so I look for another way to do something for him. That's not my motivation to get something in return, but it causes that reaction. See? And the Bible says, consider each other and find ways that you can minister to each other in that way. All right, lots of good things to dwell upon and to develop. How do I get started doing this? First thing is make a decision. Sir? Oh, yes, very much so. That's one of my biggest problems. Oh, when people want to help you, give them a chance. That's probably it. Don't force them to, but if they have an opportunity, they want to do something, they want to get up and get the next cup of coffee and help yourself, see? We had one guy here that... He wasn't ready to be able to pull this off, but he did it. He'd just ask around the table, would you like a cup of coffee? Would you like some coffee? And as soon as somebody said yes, he said, would you please get me some while you're up? I could probably get away with that, but he wasn't, he wasn't to that point. But there is a time to let other people serve, and there's a time not to serve. For instance, you guys live in an apartment together. See, and you have assignments. This guy has to clean the bathroom. You vacuum the living room. The guy cleaning the bathroom doesn't do his job. You serve him for the first week or so, and you do that for him. But after that, you sit down and talk about it and say, hey, this is your responsibility. I'm willing to serve you, but you still have bear responsibility, and from now on, I'm not touching the bathroom, so long as it's your responsibility. Because there's some training needs to be done. That person needs to develop.
That's just
kind of what I have. Oh, okay. Yeah, so there's a balance there. If somebody wants to help me, generally my first reaction is no, I can handle it myself. See? bad news. And I have a lot to work on in that. That if somebody offers to let them do something for you, get it in balance. But most of us don't have that problem. We don't serve enough to have the problem. A lot of things in life go wrong for us because we don't make the right kind of decisions, or we don't even make a decision. Before you get married, you want to make a decision that I will never divorce anybody. Sometimes there's nothing you can do about it, but as far as you're concerned, you will never get a divorce. So if you get into marriage with that concept or with that philosophy, you probably make it through. A preacher has to make a decision sometime in his life before he gets into the ministry that I am never going to allow myself to be in a counseling situation with a woman without the door being open and somebody being outside the door. Otherwise, he'll get involved with that woman. There'll become an emotional tie over spiritual matters, and he'll run off. And how many men have done that? I say it's because he never made a basic decision not to do that. And so if I'm going to be a servant, I have to make a decision. And every decision has two aspects. It has a positive and a negative side to it. Paul said to the Thessalonians, he commended them on how they turned to God from idols. See, it was a positive decision. They turned to God. In the process, it was a negative thing. It was from idols. You don't turn from something without turning to something. You gotta replace what you're doing. You just don't quit smoking. Go give yourself to something else so you take up the slack in that thing. So you don't suffer the consequences of keeping on going back to it and fighting with it. So make a decision that you're going to serve other people, and you'll be making a negative decision against yourself. That old number one is not going to be on the throne from here on in. I always liked the statement about the household of Stephanas in 1 Corinthians 16:15. It's very applicable today. It says they have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints. They got so hooked on it, they had to have a fix 4, 5, 6 times a day, just going serving somebody, doing something good for somebody else. Man, what a treat to find people like that. You know, that really makes life fun and interesting. The second thing after you make your decision against yourself and for others is to develop some attitudes. And we talked about this one, of putting others first. It's something to be developed. You will not do it overnight. So if you make a basic decision tonight that, Lord, tonight I'm going to live for other people, then tomorrow you're going to have an opportunity and you make a new decision that will confirm the basic decision. See? And then the next day or the second time tomorrow you have an opportunity to put somebody else first. You make a new decision. I will serve them right now. And you're confirming that basic decision that you made. The second element, the attitude, is of always observing. And there are three steps to observation. You saw that cigarette butt on the ground or the styrofoam cup in the bushes. That's nice. You saw it, but you didn't really observe it. Because the second step to observation is, what is my opportunity here? What can I do about that? And the third step is to take the initiative and actually do something about it. I have one person in my staff who makes a lot of observations and they keep coming in to me to correct them. See, outside the conference office we have two fancy chairs with a table between them, a lamp on them. And this is an illustration. One day they were moved over in front of the hutch over there. And this person came into my office and just almost read me the riot act, wondering why these pieces of furniture are out of place. Well, the person made a good observation, that's true. See? But why come tell me? Why not just fix it? If you don't like it that way, put it where it belongs. See? Find, that's your opportunity. Take the initiative and solve it. And then we can talk about it later. See? But the person was throwing it all on me, because they weren't following through with their observation. And I've got two interesting illustrations there that were outstanding to me. Let me just tell you a little bit about the second one first, for a second. Dan Pyatt was a navigator. He was assigned to the Billy Graham team permanently. Left the Billy Graham team and set up his own organization. And was on a navigator board of directors. And he came here one time running a little bit late. They had already started a meeting, and I met him at the front door of the castle, and I grabbed his bags and walked up the steps with him so he could get to the meeting on the third floor. And he said, Len, I've heard that the Galloping Gourmet is a Christian, and he lives someplace in Colorado. I'd like to get in touch with him. I said, Dan, I'll do all I can. So while he was in his meeting, I went downstairs. I go, how in the world do you find out who the Galloping Gourmet is? Where he lives in Colorado. That's a big assignment. So I said, Lord, what do I do? And the first thing that came to my mind was call the chef of the Broadmoor, because if anybody would know him or of him, it would be the chef of the Broadmoor. Probably circles in that same category. And so I called that guy and he said, boy, this is his name, but I don't have a fog as where he lives. Maybe the chef at the Antlers Hotel would know. So I called down there and found out that he lives up someplace by Aspen. So I called the operator and said, I want an Aspen area. And I said, I want this man's name. And she gave me his number. And I called the number to see if it was correct. And I talked to the guy's wife, and she said, he's not in present. He'll be in tomorrow morning. And so when Dan Piatt got out of the meeting, I was able to give him a note and say, Dan, I talked to this man's wife. Here's his name and address and phone number. See? I made an observation that Dan Piatt wanted to find out where the Galloping Gourmet was. He wanted to meet him. So I saw my opportunity, and I took the initiative to find out. You get the concept of that? That's the follow-through. And it's all part of it. All right, look for ways to serve. And I made it very practical because I did this for my staff here. But the principle is set others up by tending to things that will enable them to function readily and be able to succeed. We have several cars in the conference office. There's a red citation, there's a brown citation. They all have separate functions, and a blue pickup truck. And I'll guarantee you, every time I get in the red citation to go into town to the airport to pick somebody up, I get out, off the Glen, and look at the gas gauge, and it's on zero. I have to concern myself with, am I going to make it or not? Will I get to the gas station or not, see? What happened here is somebody didn't serve me by setting me up. They didn't know I was going to use the car, but no matter who was going to use it, you're going to have gas in it, see? And so before they put it back, they should have checked the gas tank, and if it was down below half, they ought to fill it up. So if somebody has to make an emergency run, they can do it. And here's the principle. Set other people up so they can succeed in what they need to do. If you get the car too dirty, go ahead and wash it first chance you get. And leave it clean for the next person because they may have to pick up some hot shot. Or they may have to get in it in their suit and tie. How many times have gone to vacuum something around here and you, instead of the vacuum picking things up, it's spitting them out in front of you. You ever had that? It's a riot. How in the world am I going to get that stuff in there? Okay. And so you tip that thing over and you find out that the belt is on twisted wrong, so it's instead of the brush pushing it in, it's going this way and pushing it out in front of you. And you take the cover off, and here it's so full of lint there that the impeller can't pull anything more through it because it's plugged up. Well, somebody didn't just take a minute to check it before they put it away, see? How full is the bag? Is it going to accept any more? How can I set the next guy up who may have to do this in just a short time to get the job done, see? Set the other person up so he can succeed in what he sets to do. You go into somebody's home, you get invited out to somebody's house, and you're going to help the woman of the house with the dishes. If she gives you any sign of, don't you dare touch my dishes, pal, then back off. Say, I'd be willing to help if you'd like me to. But don't ever force yourself on a woman. Women are very different. And some are very sensitive about the kitchen, about their dishes. And boy, they can be very offended if you just jump in there with both feet, see? Because all you need to do is break one on her, and then you've lost everything. So be sensitive in that way. But if you do have an opportunity, then when you go to put them back, put them either, if you don't know where they go or can't find where they go, then just leave them on the counter. Don't put them back where you think they ought to be. Because when she goes to set up for tomorrow's meal, you haven't served her one iota. See? You're frustrating her. All right? Lots of illustrations on that one. Last page, make others look good. Do things that will allow others to get credit. Oh, that's tough. My job at Glen Eyrie is to so perform and to so present Glen Eyrie to you and the rest of the public, the Christian public, in a way that Lauren Sanney is going to get the credit for it. So the people will write to him and say, man, you run a tremendous operation out there. I can't believe it. I mean, you talk about class A. That's the word he should get. He's getting the credit. Whether he sends that letter to me doesn't make any difference. I'm doing it so he can get the credit for it because he's the boss. And so I want to do a good job as unto the Lord. And even if he gets the credit, that's fine. Don't make any issue of a slip-up so as to embarrass another publicly. For instance, this is tremendous. One of our gals walking through the dining room one day bumped into something and the plate fell out of her hand. All that stuff went on the floor. You know what the guys do? Clap for the gal. Embarrass her to tears. I mean, it's already bad enough she dropped her plate. But we have the insensitivity to clap for it and make it more obvious. See, to get everybody's attention to it. Instead of rushing over there and saying, why don't you disappear for a minute and go get another plate and I'll clean this mess up. So you take the pressure off her. See, that's serving her. That's the idea of what we're talking about. All right, so the conclusion. How do I know when people are taking advantage of me? You can't. If I'm operating the way I've been talking about, I'm giving you the advantage and there's no way you can get ahead of me and take it. I'm always looking for ways to serve you. Isn't that tremendous? Because you know what that question is telling me? How do I know when people are taking advantage of me? I'm protecting myself. I've got this shell around me, and boy, don't you intrude on my time, my energies. Don't you violate what I want to do for myself. Man, get rid of that thing. It's a waste of time. Open yourself up and look for opportunities to serve other people. For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. The reason you get upset when you're on your way to a meeting, you're dressed up, it's raining out, and you have a flat tire halfway, the reason you get upset at that thing did not minister to you. See, you expected that thing to minister to you. You expected those four tires to function and get you there safely and on time, and they didn't do it. And so you got upset and you got angry. Jesus Christ came into the world and he didn't expect a thing out of anybody or anything. And he was never upset, never disappointed, because he knew what was in man. And if we'll adopt that kind of thinking, that kind of response, and not expect anything out of life, because if you want to look at it realistically, I spend most of my time making things right. Those Murphy's laws are so true, you can't get around it. If it can go wrong, it will, and sure enough, it does. And so you spend your life just making things right. You get this bit of information, and you get it passed out, get the word passed out that there's this many people coming, and the next thing you know, the count changed. Well, they tell you on the phone that they're going to have their meals at this hour, and they send the printed schedule in, and it's 15 minutes off. You've already passed the word out to everybody that has to know it, and then you got to sit down and think through as to who's supposed to get this word now. That doesn't minister to me. To get the change of information. But it's not supposed to. It wasn't designed to. And so I can't allow myself the luxury of getting upset at it, because that's the nature of life. So we're called to serve. Jesus Christ set the pace, and he said, happy are you if you do these things. And I've given you an opportunity here, and it might be wise if the Lord's brought anything to your mind. At the bottom of the page it says, list 3 to 5 ways you could advantage the following in the near future. We've got some categories here on the next page, and if you want to take just a minute now and just write something down that came to your mind that you could do for somebody, go ahead and write it down and try to take care of that in the next 24 hours and get started on doing this. That'll be to your advantage. It gets you thinking that way. How can I do something for somebody to benefit them? We'll just take a minute and then we'll pray and conclude.